travelers. I believe we are joined by the brilliant Zafar Benkash, who knows more about what is going on between Iran and the United States than anybody else in Canada. Are you there, Zafar?
Hello, good morning, Phil. Yes, I am, and thanks for that jingle and a nice introduction.
Well, you know as well as I do, we need your voices like yours, because actually it's a region from which you have come, and you also are a scholar. And when we watch CNN, CBS, CBC, we tend to see trained propagandists, frankly, who are very shallow. What is this? I have to ask you right away. Why do we keep hearing that there's agreements and everything is going to be fine and there's treaties, and then Trump and his administration begin to blow people up? And how dangerous is this latest thing? Is this going to, in your opinion, is this going to continue and turn into a new war? Or where do you think this is going?
Well, first of all,
I think we lost his voice.
Maybe put him up to, you know, Stone Ages, whatever. Basically, his problem is, if we can sort of, you know, zero in on the thing, there are three areas that are in contention at the present time. The first one is the Strait of Hormuz. Mm-hmm. In fact, let's step back, because the Memorandum of Understanding that was signed, the first article of the Memorandum of Understanding states that there is going to be ceasefire on all fronts, including Lebanon. So that was specifically mentioned at Iran's insistence, that a ceasefire in Lebanon and the withdrawal of Israeli forces from Lebanon is a precondition for doing anything further. Now, we know that, unfortunately, Israel has continued its attacks in Lebanon. Mm-hmm. It has, you know, occupied at least 6% of Lebanese territory in the south. And the Lebanese government also has been pressured by the U.S. to sign an agreement, even though the two countries don't have any diplomatic relations. And strangely enough, the Lebanese government has signed on to a piece of paper stating that they accept Israel's occupation of Lebanon.
Yeah, the hegemony, right, in every department.
Exactly. And the people of Lebanon, are across all political spectrums, are extremely unhappy about this, because they say, how can our own government hand over Lebanese territory? In other words, they are allowing Lebanese sovereignty to be violated by a foreign entity, and they sign on to that piece of paper. So it's not now, it's not only Hezbollah that is opposed to Israel's war on Lebanon, but the entire Lebanese population. In fact, even today, we know that Lebanon is divided into various factions, etc. Mm-hmm. But even the Sunni factions in Lebanon have condemned this agreement that the Lebanese government has entered into with Israel, of course, under American pressure. So mm-hmm. that's the first part of the problem. The second is the control of the Strait of Hormuz. Now, Iran had agreed that it will allow the opening of the Strait of Hormuz, but the condition in that agreement was that it has to be done in coordination with Iran. So any ship, any vessel, any tanker that has to pass through the Strait of Hormuz has to do so with Iran's permission. Now, of course, the U.S. keeps on insisting that there is going to be no transit fees, etc., but that can be framed in many different ways. For instance, Iran can require ships to pay, for instance, for environmental issues. It can demand ships to pay for safe passage and so on. And so there are a whole lot of ways in which these fees can be charged. And the Americans keep on insisting that the Strait of Hormuz is international waterway, but it isn't. It's in fact, if we look at it at the narrowest point, it's about 21 miles wide, and that falls well within the 12 nautical mile jurisdiction of each literal state, and the Strait of Hormuz, of course, is on one side there is Iran, on the other side there is Oman, and the two countries have agreed between them that they will jointly manage the Strait of Hormuz. And as a consequence of this American position that, you know, they have to open the Strait of Hormuz, et cetera, and the ships that were trying to squeeze through there, the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Navy fired shots at them and forced them to turn back. And that is when the Americans bombed a number of sites around the Strait of Hormuz, and in retaliation, and this all happened on Saturday, mm-hmm. and in retaliation, the Iranians targeted the U.S. 5th Fleet headquarters in Bahrain, as well as U.S. military bases in Kuwait. So altogether, 8 sites were targeted. Now, mm-hmm. yesterday, it was announced that, Trump announced this, by the way, that we have both agreed to sort of, you know, halt these tit-for-tat attacks, but there is going to be now discussions between Iran and the U.S. taking place in Qatar on Tuesday, that is June the 30th. Iran immediately issued a statement, their deputy foreign minister, that nothing is planned for this week. We're not going to hold any discussions. And he said that we are not opposed to discussions. What we want to do is that, number one, these violations of the ceasefire must stop. And secondly, now we are going to sit down and talk about the administration of the Strait of Hormuz, which is, of course, part of the, you know, memorandum of understanding. Mm-hmm. We're not going to be talking about Iran's nuclear program or its missiles, etc. That will be discussed by technical teams later on. This is also part of the memorandum of understanding. So mm-hmm. that's the second point. The third point, of course, is the release of Iran's illegally frozen assets, which is about $24 billion are sitting in Qatari banks, and there are a total of about $120 billion of Iran's frozen assets that America and other countries have illegally frozen. And Iran has insisted, again, this is part of the memorandum of understanding, that this money has to be released, even if not in its entirety, at least partially, before any discussion can take place. And today, Iran's president, Dr. Masoud Pezeshkian, announced that the first part of those $24 billion, the $6 billion would be handed over to Iran soon, and the other $6 billion will follow later, and we are working on the mechanisms as to how this money is to be released. I also want to point out that, you know, when Trump agreed that this money will be released to Iran, because he had said when he was attending the G7 summit, he admitted that, well, that's Iran's money, and we have to give it to them ultimately. We have illegally frozen it. He then sort of put this thing that, you know, Iran will not get the money. They will buy our agricultural products, you know, our yes. wheat, our soya beans, et cetera, et cetera. And
this Iran, is like dealing with bandits.
Exactly. And Iran said, we have made no such commitment. We are not going to buy your stuff. This is our money. We will spend it the way we want it. It's none of your business as to determine whether we are going to buy wheat from you or soybeans or anything else. So Trump was trying to sort of cushion the blow, because now he's forced to cough up the loot that they have, you know, illegally taken from Iran. So, you know, he has to cover it up for his own base and for the American people, because he kept on, you know, accusing Obama that yes. he had given away money to Iran after the JCPOA, mm-hmm. Although that money was only $1.7 billion, and Trump kept on saying it was $150 billion. I don't know where he came up with that figure from. But anyway, mm-hmm. now he has to admit that, you know, he has to pay Iran's money back to Iran, and it is many times more than the $1.7 billion that Obama had given. So now he has to justify it in some way that, well, they're going to buy our products, and that's why, you know, we are giving them this
that's
money.
That's a bitter pill to swallow. The way the Americans play the game is now the Democrats are saying, oh, look, he's surrendering to the terrorist state.
Exactly. That's how they always put it. But when you look at it, look at the number of people that America has killed worldwide, and also because of the attacks that took place. It was America that launched Tomahawk missiles from its the Fifth Fleet base in Bahrain that struck that girls' school in Minab, where 168 young girls aged between 7 to 12 were murdered in cold blood. I mean, you know, they carry out these kinds of operations. Then when Trump was asked this question, he said, you know, what do you have to say to that? This was only recently in France. He said, oh, that was a long time ago, so there's such a terrible question. Yeah. Why are you asking me this question?
Yeah, 2 weeks. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, it's I read it. You know, there seems to be some movement amongst the Gulf states. They're obviously not so enthusiastic as they once were about having American bases, but it appears, I mean, with the with this business of breaking ceasefires that the U.S. is engaging in, they will, that issue won't go away unless they tell the Americans that we to leave, right?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, a number of Gulf state commentators, etc., have said that these bases, far from providing any protection to us, act as triggers for retaliation, and they are a source of instability for us. In fact, today the Wall Street Journal actually carried a report that America may have to shut down these bases and move them further west and perhaps locate them in Israel. In particular, the Wall Street Journal mentioned, and also, you know, one of the think tanks, Middle East Institute, that perhaps the U.S. Fifth Fleet headquarters may have to be moved away from there, as well as their bases in Kuwait and in Saudi Arabia. So we are beginning to see that, American media outlets as well as their think tanks are already talking in terms of moving these bases because they cannot be defended against Iran's drones and missile strikes. And so perhaps, you know, the Americans themselves are coming to this conclusion, in addition to those Gulf states that feel much more vulnerable. In fact, those states are now reaching out to Iran and saying that, you know, Iran has been saying this all along, that, you know, we can't change geography. We are neighbors, and we would like to live in peace with you. Mm-hmm. And so now these Arabian regimes, with the exception of Bahrain and Kuwait, but others, including the UAE, has now come to this point that they have to deal with Iran, whether they like it or not, and they have to live with them because they are neighbors. So if I were to point out in terms of their attitude, Oman and Qatar are the least hostile to Iran, followed by now Saudi Arabia. The United Arab Emirates has also come around to becoming less hostile, even though it has very close relations with Israel. But they've realized that, you know, if they want to survive, if they want their economy to thrive, because they need foreign investment and tourists, etc., and those will not materialize if there is instability or uncertainty. And only Iran can provide that stability and you know, peace to them. So they are coming around to that conclusion as well. Yeah. Bahrain, for, you know, unfortunately, a tiny country with a total population of about 1 million, but the vast majority, about 90% of Bahrain's population is Shia, which means they have the same sort of religious orientation as Iran, and a tiny minority is ruling the country with the help of American support, with Jordanian mercenaries there and so on. And so they have adopted a hostile attitude, but I think they will come around to changing their attitude because they will have no choice when we look at the other Gulf Cooperation Council countries. Kuwait is a really, really nasty piece of work because, you know, Kuwait is really putting its neck out in trying to, you know, allow its bases to be used to attack Iran. And I want to remind your listeners that it was Kuwait back in the 80s when Saddam Hussein was attacking Iran. Kuwaiti tankers were actually pumping out Iraqi oil and sending it and supplying it on the international markets. And Iran had warned Kuwait not to do that, but Kuwait continued to do that. Mm-hmm. And yet, in its magnanimity, after the war was over, Iran did not retaliate against Kuwait. It said, you know, whatever you did in the past, we forgive you, but please don't do this again. And yet we see again Kuwait behaving in the same unfriendly and hostile manner. And I think it will pay a price for doing that, because everybody now is aware that Iran is not a pushover. It is able to stand up for its rights. It will defend its rights and its sovereignty and its integrity, and it has the capacity to do so.
Yeah. By the way, I want to ask you right there. I mean, haven't one of the things that has shocked people who thought they knew that you know, they created this myth, and you remember months back they had the Shah and they had Israel and they had demonstrations that they're going to liberate the people of Iran. It turns out that the Iranians are quite united. They were before, and they're much more now, are they not?
Absolutely. In fact, those demonstrations that took place, those were now it has been openly admitted by the Israelis and the Americans that they were instigating these riots. And, you know, during those 3 days of riots that started in January, the government of Iran had ordered its police forces not to carry any weapons while these demonstrations were taking place. I mean, the Iranian police were completely unarmed in the streets. That's why more than 300 of them were killed by these rioters who went on a rampage, who killed, you know, thousands of people.
Western media never mentioned that the demonstrators were armed, and it was at night. It was at night.
Exactly. And they killed so many innocent people, and it was only after 3 days of this absolute criminal activities by these rioters, Israeli-backed rioters, American-backed rioters. They were being, you know, Trump even admitted that we had sent weapons through the Kurds, and the Kurds didn't hand over the weapons to these rioters. But there were other, you know, weapons that were smuggled to them. And when the Iranian government sort of finally decided that they had to take action against them, because these rioters were not only attacking police stations, they were attacking banks, they were setting fire to hospitals, to, you know, ambulances, all kinds of civilian, you know, structure, et cetera, and killing innocent people, then the government cracked down. And in fact, they... You know, the figures that have been quoted, like they said, oh, they've killed 10,000 people, then it moved to 30,000, then 40,000, then 50,000.
I mean, all, it's impossible. All to justify an assault on the country.
Exactly. In fact, Iran itself published the names of all of the people that were killed, and they said that there were a total of three.
Hello?
Out of which 2,997 or something were innocent civilians. Mm-hmm. And that means that the people that were killed during those riots were actually killed by the rioters. And of course, the rioters were also then killed when the police took action against them to bring the situation under control. And then we saw that within 1 or 2 days after that, millions of Iranians came out into the streets in support of the government because they were fed up of these foreign agents and instigators destroying civilian property. And now to complete this picture, we know that, you know, although claims were made that the people of Iran were against the government, but we saw that, you know, every day during the war, hundreds of thousands of Iranians came out into the streets in support of their government.
They stood on the bridges and the dams.
Yes, when America threatened to bomb their bridges, bomb their refineries, the people came and they made a human chain on bridges, on refineries and their, you know, dams, etc., so that America would not be able to destroy those facilities. So we see that, you know, this propaganda that the people of Iran are against the government, et cetera, is completely false. And in any case, I think anybody with any sense of, you know, how governments work, if the people are not in support of their government, that government cannot successfully defend its territory or wage a war, in particular against two massively armed military powers like the United States and Israel. And I think this is generally recognized even by now American neocons, people like Robert Kagan, for instance, writing in The Atlantic. He admitted that America lost this war. Iran won the war. And there have been other commentators that have openly declared that Iran performed in a way that was completely unexpected, notwithstanding Trump's claim that he has sunk the Iranian Navy 7 times or 8 times. He has wiped out the Iran's air force. He has wiped out their missile, you know, production facilities. If that were the case, Iran would not be able to retaliate against American aggressive acts as Iran did, and it continues to do to this day. So it is absolutely clear that the people of Iran are solidly behind their government. They want to make sure that their government is able to withstand these aggressors, stand up to these aggressors and defend Iran's integrity and sovereignty.
Yeah. And once again, as in 1979, the world is impressed. Countries like Mexico fell in love with the Iranian soccer team. And there's a sense that this is the country that is really standing up to America, which is the biggest test for any country.
Absolutely. And, you know, a few days ago, there was this massive earthquake in Venezuela, and Iran, despite all its own difficulties, it said it is going to send help to the people of Venezuela. I think that shows their humanity and their compassion. Yes. And they're not just for their own country, but for people who are suffering all over the world.
Well, Zafar Bengash, Crescent International, wonderful. We really needed to be told these things because we're not going to find out on the mainstream media, are we?
Unfortunately not, yes.
Well, thank you very, very much.
It's my great pleasure, Phil. Take care. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. This is Taylor Report, CIUT, 89.5 FM. We pardon for the occasional glitch. Gremlins. Anything went wrong during World War II, they would say, must have been the gremlins. So just to wind up then, we thank David Jacobs for his contribution. And please remember, go to standforparents.org, get some leadership and take the arguments from there to anybody who might help influence the opinion of the UN Security Council. I was at Tank Pedro and tell you that 33:45:78 is coming up. I think we're going to hear some Bob Dylan with his usual good point about people who cause wars. We'll see you next week.